So welcome everyone to the third seminar this term organised by the Oxford Comparative Criticism and Translation Group, the OCCT. My name is Kasia Szymańska and I'm a Junior Research Fellow in Slavonic Languages here at Oxford and also a member of the organising committee of the OCCT programme. And today we will discuss different aspects of translating literature from marginalised European languages into English, and more specifically for the British market. And to this end, we've brought together four very prominent and prolific translators of modern Greek, Swedish, Polish, and Dutch, and they kindly agreed to be here with us today to talk about their translation work and the ups and downs of translating marginalised languages into English. But before I introduce our guests properly, let me just briefly explain the focus of our today's conversation. As you've seen, the title is rather dramatic, Forgotten Europe. And it also might be interpreted as a more general allusion to the current political situation in this country. But here today, the idea was to focus on even more forgotten languages, something even more forgotten than the already forgotten part of the world, the part of the world that England is so eager to forget anyway. When I say that we will focus on minor or small or marginalized languages, every time I use these labels, I don't mean exactly the same thing. Mostly because we, for example, in terms of the number of speakers, some of these languages are actually relatively big for European standards, so Polish with 55 million speakers, or Dutch with 28 million speakers could be rather labeled as medium-sized languages in some categories. But for example, according to the most recent report prepared by the Literature Across Frontiers in 2015, spanning the period of over two decades, none of these languages made it to the top five most frequently translated languages in the UK.
I couldn't get any reply from my correspondent, so I don't know whether we did just ease into the top five, but probably not.
Because according to that report, unfortunately the last entry was from 2012, and according to that report, Swedish was the sixth most often translated language, but because it was on the rise just before the report ended, we don't know whether actually it made the top five or not. But for the sake of this conversation, we are forgetting about this peak that Swedish reached in 2011 and 2012. Then, according to this report, Dutch was on the eighth place, Polish on the 11th, and Modern Greek on the 14th place. So I think it's safe to assume, for the sake of this conversation, that we'll be discussing and comparing the situation of the languages that don't necessarily fall into the rubric of mainstream ones, so the mainstream literary production, and also because literary translation is a niche in its own right, amounting to only 3.2% of the books published yearly, both for Britain and Ireland. So first I'll introduce our guests, of course, and then before I open the floor to more questions, I also ask our guest translators to read from the translations they are currently working on, just to give you an idea or to show you how exciting minor literature can be. So first of all, let me introduce Antonia Lloyd-Jones.
Hello.
Who's a full-time translator of Polish literature and twice winner of the Found in Translation Award. She has translated works by several Poland's leading contemporary novelists, including Paweł Hille and Jacek Denel, and authors of reportage, including Szczygieł and Jagielski. She also translates crime fiction, poetry, essays, and books for children. She's a mentor for the Emerging Translators Mentorship Programme and co-chair of the UK Translators Association. Then Sarah Deff has been translating Swedish literature of many periods and genres into English for over 30 years. She's one of the directors of the small UCL-based Scandinavian specialist publisher Norvik Press, and from 2003 to 2015, She was the editor of Swedish Book Review, the magazine of the Swedish English Literary Translators Association. In recent years, she has been a mentor in the BCLC and Writers' Centre Norwich Emerging Translator Mentorship Scheme, which is, I think,
same one.
She has twice won the George Bernard Shaw Prize for translation from Swedish, and in 2014, she received the Royal Order of the Polar Star for services to Swedish literature. Paul Vincent is an experienced literary translator for more than 20 years, with a strong academic background in literature, linguistics, and translation theory, teaching, and practical interpreting experience. Paul studied modern languages, German, French, and Dutch at Cambridge. Then he taught Dutch languages and literature at University of London. And since 1989, he has been a full-time freelance translator. And Paul also gave me a very long list of his published translations. And I'm afraid that if I were to read all the titles now, we wouldn't have the time for the actual event. But just to give you an idea of how vast and rich his translation output is, let me just say that his translations from Dutch span many periods and genres, ranging from medieval poetry to contemporary fiction and non-fiction. In 2014, Paul was shortlisted for the Oxford Weidenfeld Prize for Irving Mortier's While the Gods Were Sleeping. Mm-hmm. And last year, he was a joint winner of the Oxford Weidenfeld Prize for his collection 100 Dutch Language Works from the Medieval Period to the Present Day. It was translated with John Irons. And finally, on that further side, Peter Mackridge is Emeritus Professor of Modern Greek at the University of Oxford. His books include The Modern Greek Language and Language and National Identity in Greece, as well as two co-authored grammars of Modern Greek. He has written the introduction to the collected poems of Kavafi in the Oxford World Classic Series. He has published translations of novels and short stories by 19th century and 20th century Greek writers, and poems by Kavafi and George Seferis, among others, plus a volume of Seferis' journals of his travels in Cappadocia. Mm. His books in English have also been published in Greek translation. Mm. So thank you all for coming and being here with us today. We'll start with a very personal question about your own fascination with your language area and what initially attracted you to the author's books, or more generally, the country whose literature you translate. So, I'm not sure what
you'd
like to. Maybe, anyone would like to.
Would you like? Okay, well, let's start. If you like, I feel that I'm here in a way under false pretenses, because I'm the most amateur translator of the four here. Some of us are not amateurs at all, but I'm the most amateur. And I've never really seen myself. Translation has never been a central focus of my work. I mean, I've been teaching and researching on modern Greek language and literature all these years at university, but translation had just been a sort of side work, and it's been a very Greek thing, in the sense that I've just sort of selected things that I happen to like, and then somehow I've managed to find publishers through friends. It's always personal contacts. Only once did have I been paid for a translation, and that was by a Greek cultural foundation in London that decided a couple of decades ago to have a series of translations of Greek fiction, and they were subsidized by this cultural foundation, so I was actually paid for translating something, but that's the only thing that I've ever been paid for. And even that book, there's a stories by somebody called Yorgos Ioannou, even that book was published in Greece by a Greek publisher. Most of my translations have been published, well, they've all been published by what I would describe as micro publishers, rather like micro breweries, and sort of interesting tastes, but most of them have been in Greece, although my most recent one, which is a history of Western philosophy in 100 haiku by Haris Raginos, was published by a little publisher in Dublin called Daedalus or Daedalus, I don't even know how to pronounce it, but nothing to do with the one in Cambridge, which has a similar name. There again, I mean, I happen to be a friend of the poet, and he sort of helped to get the translation done. So I haven't really had to face much challenge, I'm afraid. It's just been things kind of whatever, they just turn up and get published. So let me leave it to the more serious let me leave it to the more serious people to tell you what they've been doing.
Well, I got into Swedish through sheer cussedness, and I think that cussedness has probably stood me in good stead ever since.
Yeah.
Because I was enjoying my German still at school in the sixth form, but I was fed up with French. And so I was going to do joint honours somewhere. Yeah, and I thought, well, what should I go for? I'll choose something that nobody will have done at school. And, you know, I haven't got any Swedish family connections, boyfriend, all the usual stuff, none of that. Just took a reckless leap into the dark. And luckily, I liked it.
You had a soft landing.
Yes. And I found my niche there, and I've sort of stayed there ever since. With a few...
She does other languages too.
Well, a bit of Norwegian, but really mainly Swedish, because surprisingly enough, to my surprise, there has been enough work.
Mm.
Yes. So, unlike you, I haven't had friends in right places very often, so I've had to launch myself out into the world of commercial publishing and try to get paid for it.
Mm.
And it takes a long time to get a foot in the door, I must say. Like about 10 years, but in recent years things have been going all right.
I'm a bit like Sarah in where I've reached now, but I studied Russian, and I hadn't really any idea of studying Polish until I've been to the Soviet Union a few times and decided just how appalling it really was. Russians are the biggest monsters on earth and all the rest of it. I went to Poland during martial law, and the original reason for learning Polish was 6 foot two or three with black curls and green eyes, which is quite a good incentive. but then I felt, I was a very sort of militant student, and I felt a great need to fight against communism. And I wanted to learn Polish really to become a journalist and write about Poland, about what was happening there. But then I found that actually my heart was more in telling Western people about Polish culture. I felt as if I could give Poland its rightful place in Europe by contributing to that. And for ages I had sensible jobs as well as translating. But then for the last, well, this is year 17 of being... relying totally and utterly on translation to earn my living, and I've translated with the biggest publisher in the world as well as some of the micros. But it is very hard work. It is unpredictable. It's like buses, you know, they all come along at once, or else, you know, you wait ages. At the moment this year I have the buses have all come along at once, and they've all crashed into each other's backs because it's the London Book Fair has decided to make Poland its so-called market focus country, and I keep thinking to myself, when the gods wish to punish us, they answer our prayers. I just wish I didn't have so much work to do. That's why I was almost late.
When people ask me, I want to say I backed into Dutch, but it's not really the whole story. I was doing modern languages at Cambridge, and that meant that every second person I was doing French or German or some combination of the other major languages, and I thought it was time for a change. I'd been to Holland in my first long vacation, and I could almost make sense of the language on the basis of German, and there were, apart from these strange combinations of vowels and consonants cluttering up notice boards and so on. And if I found it an interesting country, and so I added Dutch component to my second part of my degree. I was lucky to have an inspirational teacher, Peter King, still going strong in his 90s, and a small cohort of contemporaries who were both comrades and rivals. So a perfect situation. I didn't look back from there. I went on after a postgraduate year in Amsterdam to teach Dutch at London University, before eventually going freelance as a translator. It was during my university period that I encountered some of the writers who really stayed with me, the novelist and epigrammist Montatulli, the novelist Couperus, the writer Elsort, and poets like Gazella and Huerta. They may mean nothing to you, but they all were imprinted on me at that first time. I think that's what I would say about my beginnings, anyway. I can say a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of translation later.
And if most of you are freelance translators, then I imagine that there is some demand for this literature, for published Swedish or Dutch literature. So I wonder, besides personal reasons, if there were any, I don't know, Antonio already mentioned, for example, this Cold War or the period of the Soviet Union, right? So I wonder whether there were any historical or cultural or broader events that could have sparked a more intense interest in these literatures.
Well, if I can start again. Certainly, I mean, for Greece, there are obvious connections with the classical world, which foreigners sometimes see, which a lot of Greeks like to see, although the real connections are much less than what people like to see. But I would say historically that it's very important to remember, especially when Greece is going through its terrible crisis at the moment, how important Greece has been to Western European culture since the 1940s. Starting with 1940-41, which was a period during the Second World War when Greece was Britain's only ally on the continent of Europe fighting the Axis. And then Greece was still in the public eye during the Civil War. Secondly, of course, very important, Oxfam. Oxfam was founded because Greeks were starving to death. Mm-hmm. Academics in Oxford set up Oxfam because of Greeks. That's been such an amazing story since then. The Greek Civil War, that was where one in Europe, if you like, where the Cold War began, perhaps. It was very important at that time. Then we have the Colonel's dictatorship of 67-74, when so many British people, were very, very exercised, quite rightly, about, the return of democracy to Greece. And then, of course, now, sadly, the crisis, political, economic, social crisis. So, there are times when Greece comes into the public eye. It's usually when things are going very badly, of course. Now, just to take an example, in the last, since the end of, I think, of 2015, so since only just a year, there's been no fewer than three years. There's been no fewer than three anthologies of Greek poetry translated in English, but poetry of the crisis, okay, three anthologies of poetry of the crisis, including one published by Penguin called Austerity Measures, edited by a former student of mine, Karen Van Dyke. And her introduction, Karen's introduction, was excerpted in The Guardian, and then the book was reviewed, I think, the next week. I was amazed to find that her book was number three in the bestsellers of The Guardian, bookshop. The first, the top, by the way, was the book by Yanis Varoufakis, and the weak suffer what they must, Europe, austerity, and the threat to global stability. So it was one of the few times in the last few years when Greek books about Greece or by Greeks, have been really in the news, but for the wrong reasons, if you like.
I suppose when you come to think about Sweden of the past decades, we go back to the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s and the films of Ingmar Bergman, and everyone got very excited about those, but I don't know whether it actually stimulated much translation. There was also a perception for a time that we needed a lot of input from the Swedes to help us with more liberated and egalitarian and equality aware children's literature, and there were a lot of books for teenagers and also picture books for younger children that came in. I think more recently possible things that stimulated interest were unfortunately of a negative kind, such as the murder of Olof Palme, the Prime Minister, and latterly the other Swedish minister, Anna Lindh, and of course in Norway the terrible Anders Breivik massacre. But really the thing that's been driving it in recent years has been the explosion of Scandinavian or Nordic crime fiction, which has transformed things for translators, I must say. And whatever we think about crime fiction, it has also opened up a lot of other possibilities for translators, because you've got publishers coming into the market who had never really dipped their toe into translation before. They found it worked, they found they could do it, they found they could sell the books, and that has actually led to to more translations of many kinds in many minority languages, probably.
With Polish, it's you would think that because of all historical connections with Britain, that there would be more interest, but there's dreadfully stereotypical thinking about Polish people and literature and culture. And in this country, people tend to think, oh, jolly good fighters, what, you know, and then the minute it sinks in that this is a country that was behind the Iron Curtain, is part of Eastern Europe, it's really rather foggy in the British mind. And there was always some interest among Polonia here and in the US, but Polish literature has had a pretty hard time getting through. Mm-hmm. And when I started, there was extremely little, really, and only an interest in some kind of mega classics of a rather heavy-duty kind, and not much interest in the contemporary literature. I think I'm just about the only translator who specialises in the contemporary writers, in fact. Mm. Almost everybody else does Gombrowicz and Słowacki and all these great names. But luckily, most of my authors are alive. And then you would think that there would be interest as a result of things like Solidarity and the whole fall of the wall and so on. Little flutter, but not really. And one of the difficulties with Polish literature is that it is terribly self-referential, and that's a result of the country's difficult history, that Poles inevitably end up in their literature kind of gazing at their navels and writing a great deal about what's going on in their own context. There's the old joke about the elephant and it's the elephant and the Polish question. And that puts people off because it's too introverted. Recently, crime fiction also has helped Poland to pull itself up by its bootstraps in terms of breaking through in translation. And I've had a lot of success with that, and we're trying to get other things riding on its coattails. Very usefully, some of the authors of more traditional novels have written their own pastiches of crime novels, or have taken up writing crime fiction of a very literary and rather wonderful kind. So that's actually helped, because it's helped us get their other books better known. And then, of course, nowadays, we have the whole European Union question and the fact that there are an awful lot of Poles here. I get asked so often, oh, it must be marvellous for you, there's all these Polish people in Britain, it must make a huge difference to your work. Well, why would it? First of all, most of the Poles who come here don't read any books at all in any language. The bulk of them don't. And then the ones who do can read those books in Polish, so why would they read a translation? Where it is good is that quite often it means that when you have a public event, you get more people coming in, and you would hope that they would bring British people in. And the thing I've noticed is that there's always people with a partner who is British or Polish, the other way around, and they desperately want their boyfriend or girlfriend to know about their culture, so they get them to buy a book. So I'm quite happy about that. But it is, of course, becoming more of an issue, and perhaps I've noticed there's a lovely new phenomenon, which is Poles writing about their experiences in Britain.
Yeah.
And some of these books were terrible at first, and I kept thinking, it would be just embarrassing, like fodder for UKIP to translate these books. So I'm just not going to do it. But now there's starting to be some really good ones. And my latest mentee is working on one by a young Pole who's actually half Greek, because a lot of Greeks, after the colonels went to Poland, he's written a book about that too. So he's called Dionysios Sturis, a traditional Polish name, if ever there was. And he went to work at a mussel cleaning plant on the Isle of Man, and has been going there ever since for about 10 years. He's written a beautiful book about Poles in Britain, about the Isle of Man, and about the history of it. For instance.
And did you write that in Polish?
Yes.
You translated it?
No, my mentee's working on it.
Because I believe there are Polish writers living in London
who write in English. Yes, that's also true.
Yeah, new phenomenon, perhaps.
For Dutch, the obvious hook is the Golden Age, and specifically art history. But that's in fact been largely appropriated by English in such books as Girl with a Pearl Earring. You can think of this miniaturist. and in for non-fiction, Tulip Fever.
Mm.
And another area that has some attraction, sometimes north of the border, is an austere kind of Calvinism, which you find represented in writers like Jan Volkers and Martin et Hart. Other areas which are obvious attraction points are the Jewish persecution, with Anne Frank as the icon, and the swinging Amsterdam of the 1960s, which is the image of hedonism still persists. So those are the things I think I would say.
Right. So I think Paul and Antonio already mentioned some cultural stereotypes and genres that are for some reason more popular among the readers because they are based on some expectations, the audience's expectations.
I don't think they're popular necessarily.
Not necessarily.
No, I think it puts people off. For instance, with Polish literature, inevitably there's a vast amount about the war and about the Holocaust particularly that's translated. And these are very important books, and it's good that they exist and they need to be there. But I think people get fatigued very easily. So somebody will read one book about that and then they'll say, right, job done. I've read this depressing, harrowing, torturous book. And they then brand the whole of that literature like that. They think it's always going to be doom and gloom and Kieślowski-style misery. But it isn't. There's funny things in Polish, would you believe?
Yeah, I mean, it's true that the publishers and readers are getting more sophisticated. And thriller, a very sophisticated thriller by Hermann Koch, is about to be, or has just been made into a major film with Richard Gere, which will do wonders on hope for the sales of that book for a start. And it's, I think there's certainly a spin-off from Scandinavian noir there as well.
Yes, well, I mean, you talked about doom and gloom. Of course, that has been Sweden's stock in trade. That's what everybody long thought was what you got from Sweden. And of course, we see that carrying on in all these moody antisocial detectives who we get in books and then in films and televised versions as well, even shifting on further now to the autism spectrum ones like Saga Noreen on the Bridge and so on. I don't think publishers have been particularly sophisticated in what they've picked up on. They've attempted in recent years to market sort of light-hearted, humorous, feel-good books, which I think have been rather feeble. Things like The 100-Year-Old Man who jumped out of a window and disappeared, and The Little Old Lady Who Broke All the Rules. Really awful. But the publisher thought, for a while at least, that was what the punters wanted. And, you know, ridiculous things like recently... You've probably seen all these books that came out for Christmas about the Danish concept of hygge and coziness and candles and jumpers and all that, which you really can't make five books out of like they try to. And such things as chopping wood and how to stack your wood pile.
That's a good Scandinavian activity,
yeah.
Is it?
And apparently this shifts copies, but it doesn't do much for Swedish classics or for good contemporary Swedish or Finland Swedish, for that matter, fiction, unfortunately.
I mean, cultural stereotypes as far as Greece is concerned is rather more difficult for me to deal with. I don't keep up to date actually with what's being published in Greece nowadays, but I mean, looking back over a long period, when I was first studying modern Greek in Oxford in the 60s, the most popular Greek novelist was Kazantzakis, and then everybody was going to see Zorba the Greek, and I remember going with my fellow students from St. John's to the Maudlin Street Cinema and seeing Zorba the Greek in 1965 or something, and we all came out sort of putting our arms on each other's shoulders and dancing across Maudlin Street, dancing with Sirtaki. And so that was the idea of the Greek as the sort of Mediterranean, as the happy-go-lucky, living for the day, all that sort of business, which is, it's only one small side of Greek life, of course. The other thing, of course, at the same time, was more or less the opposite. You know, people in Britain being attracted by poets such as Sepheris and Kavafi because of the fact that they drew on the classical tradition, which, you know, British classicists and whatever highly educated people in Britain could also draw on and get into it. And of course, Kavafi has, although Sepheris is not so well read nowadays, I mean, he's still occasionally surfaces in English. I mean, I don't mean in translation, I mean people referring to him. Gaddafi, of course, has remained and will go on. And it's extraordinary that Gaddafi's poems, of course, the so-called canon of his poems consists of entirely of 154 poems. It's like the 154 sonnets of Shakespeare. So it's not a large oeuvre, but that canon has been published in volume form, at least in 12 different translations by 12 different people, which is because it's extraordinary, and it just goes on. Of course, sorry, Daniel, I get names, I can't get names. You know, the person who did the American, Daniel Mendelssohn, who published his translation about 5 years ago, I suppose is the most famous. I'm just talking about cultural stereotypes, but I mean, what's happening now in Greece? I mean, what younger people are producing, and neither anything to do with Zorba the Greek or anything to do with the classical world. You know, I mean, it's quite different and much more to do with, you know, Greece as a problematic country in the Balkans, you know, very much in its geographical area, and without so much of historical dimension.
Yeah. Of course, when I was talking about doom and gloom, I did forget the master, Strindberg.
Right.
And, you know, he still crops up, Ibsen as well, they still crop up on the stage. Mm-hmm. But Strindberg wrote many fine novels, and I admire his novels much more, but they don't really get out very much. We are trying to rectify that a bit at Norvik Press, but I don't know to what avail.
Well, how about Nobel Prize winners? Because it seems to me, well, Strindberg didn't win the Nobel Prize.
Yes, there is a certain amount of interest in Nobel Prize winners. In fact, there's a fascination with how they are chosen, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But in recent years, in recent decades, not all that many of them have been Scandinavian, because they actually realised they were giving too many of the prizes to their own country. And so I think it was in the early 70s or so, they actually set up a Nordic prize, which was going to sort of take on that role.
Mm.
And that since then, they have really only awarded the Nobel Prize to a Swede or another Nordic writer very infrequently. Thomas Tranströmer was a notable exception recently, but yes, they realised they were overdoing it.
So from what you're saying, it also seems that, well, you're very optimistic when it comes to the taste of publishers, and so they become more sophisticated, apparently. And I wonder if you were, for example, Antonia, if you were to offer a novel about, you know, like a Swedish, a patient in the mental house somewhere, or if someone was, I don't know, for example, Peter, if you were to offer a dissident novel happening, taking place in communist era, do you think publishers are really that flexible when it comes to, you know, different genres, different themes, something that actually breaks the usual cultural stereotypes?
Well, I know a publisher who is currently having a novel translated, which actually won the prestigious August Prize, which is about a mental hospital and the inmates. But I think largely I'm not optimistic about publishers thinking, you know, in a more sophisticated way. I think they are manipulated mainly by agents and by the need to avoid risk. There has been an absolute mushrooming of literary agents in Scandinavia in the last 15 years, perhaps, and they have entirely distorted the market, in my opinion.
Mm.
But that might not be the case.
Yeah, we don't have
the rest
Polish,
of
the year. There isn't such a thing as an agent on the whole.
No.
Some Polish authors have started having agents here, but very few.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, it's a few of the enterprising Polish publishers who have rights departments that sell books. So that's why translators are very important on the Polish theme when it comes to getting books published abroad, because we act sort of as agents.
Agents combined, aren't you? Yes.
And we don't do the negotiation for writers, but we do very often put the pieces together of producing information about a particular book that's caught a translator's eye. The translator will then make an effort to produce material about that book to be shown to publishers. and work along with the Polish publisher to promote the book and pitch it to the right publishers in Britain or the United States. You said the British market. I translate into English. Mm-hmm. I don't translate for Britain only. I translate for the English-speaking world, which could be just about anywhere that speaks English.
Yes.
I mean, one of my mentees has just had a book published in India, in English, for instance.
Yeah.
So we were always thinking in terms of the whole English-speaking world, not just Britain or not just... Some things do better in one particular, on one side of the Atlantic rather than another.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't always purely think in those terms.
No.
Sometimes I know that I should pitch things to
yes.
American publishers rather than British, but
yes.
you always hope for a book to appear on both sides
and
of the Atlantic.
And it often does, doesn't it?
Yeah. And
yeah.
you can sometimes
yeah.
push them towards it. You can encourage the publishers to co-translate or to sell your book on to somebody else on the other side.
Yes, you have to be very flexible. I mean, there are people, publishers, publishing Swedish material in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, I've had books out in New Zealand.
There's a Swedish a publisher of children's literature in New Zealand. Yes.
Yeah. And there's an Australian publisher, Scribe, that's
yes.
now started up in the UK.
Mm.
And so there's really, that is all one world, English-speaking world, when it
yeah.
comes to...
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, I was talking about micro-publishers, and the publishers who published my translations had very little, you know, until a few years ago, they would have no distribution network, practically.
Mm.
So the books would be sold only at Athens Airport or something,
yes.
at the newspaper store or something like that. You know, somebody wants to, either coming in or going out of Greece, wants to have some idea of about some literature. But of course, with Amazon, although we may not like Amazon as a company, it means that these books that I've done, which are published in Greece and would have no distribution otherwise, they're available to anybody in the world.
Yes.
So it is a global
yes.
market,
that's
even
right.
for a small publisher.
And
I know, you know, I'm a great friend of one of the publishers, you know, and she only she actually has to, she's one person publisher living in Greece, English, and she has to actually physically, you know, pack up and take to the post office
yeah.
every single copy that she sells.
Yeah.
But she says, it's amazing how many I'm selling at this book.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
you know, it's only a small number, but at least she can do it. Whereas before Amazon, she would have no way of getting through to the international
audience. These small and micro publishers have become very adept at using things like blogs and social media
yeah.
and so on that they didn't have access to before, which has all helped to get the message out.
Mm. And e-books too.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes. There's a change. But it's interesting you saying that Swedish has been taken over by agents.
Mm, very largely.
I don't know.
Do you mean, sorry, can I just ask for clarification? You mean the translations of Swedish books, or you mean Swedish books published in Sweden in Swedish?
Well, both.
The
agents have become much more important than they were when I first came on the scene.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can see this creeping with the Polish, because Poland has now suddenly produced a whole lot of pretty second-rate crime novels, and there's a huge amount being spewed out now in by Polish publishers.
Yes,
and because of crime fiction being this sort of strange thing that every now and then some wonderful thing takes off, and it's usually complete crap, but for some reason people here like it, perhaps on the telly or something. And I don't read crime, I only translate one crime writer to, and I say to him, you're my pension mate, that's why I do it. But and I get very angry and change the plots. that's another story. With his permission, with his collaboration. We can talk about that later. But the thing is that it means that agents who are interested in making money and the sort of big commercial publishers who think in terms of vast amounts of money coming pouring in are starting to take an interest in Polish literature. Whereas before, I've always been pitching books to the small elite of independent publishers who specialise in translated books and who are interested in very good writing and not rubbish.
Yeah. And how does it work with Dutch language? I mean, I wonder whether there's any role of, for example, cultural institutes. Both
absolutely, yes.
The Dutch one is one of the best,
We're very fortunate in having not one but two NGOs, which are subsidised translation, which are active at book fairs, most recently at Frankfurt, where Dutch was guest of honour.
Mm.
And from that have flowed indirectly, if you like, two major translations. One, a very large volume of Dutch short stories, 500 pages long. And the second, a classic from the 1940s called The Evenings, a book which was heralded as a masterpiece in the press, which has just been published in America with 10,000 copies, and actually an unprecedented edition size for that. So these two institutions also, very importantly, run a list of approved translators. So if, when it comes to anyone thinking of eventually of a career in literary translation, goes through this particular hoop that does a test translation for one or other of the, or both of these two institutions, the Dutch Foundation for Literature, the Flemish Foundation for Literature. And if accepted, is then recommended to publishers who are interested.
Wow.
I think that's what I would say on that for
Dutch. Is there support with Dutch? I know that translators into Dutch get financial support from the state.
Yes.
Like a dream. But if you're translating from Dutch, is that also the case that because I know I've been in Amsterdam, they have this wonderful translator's house where you can do residencies, and I've done that myself.
Right.
By accident, I've been there. It's fabulous. It's this
Flanders
beautiful
has a similar
house.
Translator's house too, but not as elaborate as in Amsterdam, no.
And the staircase is like this.
Yes.
You have to be quite brave.
Yes. So the subsidy is indirect. It's to the publisher, or to the translator via the publisher.
Yes.
It's a top up, if you like.
Right.
For the publisher.
The Polish state also has. An organisation that's dedicated to promoting its literature at home and abroad, which is the Polish Book Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And they provide grant funding for translations too. So we have we're very lucky to have that, actually, because there are other languages. I mean, poor old Greeks, of course, they don't have that now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about Sweden.
Well, we have the Swedish Arts Council, which certainly gives translators a lot of support, but their funding has been cut in recent years, and so it's getting quite competitive. If publishers apply for support. And also they want very much to support contemporary writing. So if you are trying, as we are at Norvik Press, to retranslate the classics, then you're not really in with a chance. So we've had to try applying to other bodies. There's the Swedish Academy. I think it's the Nobel Prize effect, because she was there. She was a member of the Swedish Academy, and she was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize, my author Selma Lagerlöf.
Oh, yes.
So we have managed to get several grants on a continuing basis, although we don't ask too often, from the Swedish Academy for our Lagerlöf in English series. And in Finland, they have FILI, Finnish Literature Abroad, which gives grants for Finnish and for Finland Swedish literature. So we do have some support, but it never goes far enough, and it doesn't always cover the entire translation cost, so you're always left looking for other sources.
No, as Antonio's implied, I mean, in Greece in the good old days when Greek state had money, I mean, a lot of private people in Greece have a lot of money, I'm talking about the Greek state, you know, there were subsidies for translations from Greek into other languages from the Greek Ministry of Culture, and there was also the National Book Centre, which was very good at publicising Greek books within Greece, but also abroad, and producing, you know, sort of working with publishers and producing, when at Frankfurt and other book fairs, you know, producing all the publicity at the expense of the state, really, getting the publishers' publicity for books translated into English and whatever, and producing leaflets and things. But the National Book Centre has been closed down, and it doesn't exist any longer.
Okay.
So, you know, that's not there anymore, and the Ministry of Culture still exists, but I never hear about it. I don't think it does very much. It certainly doesn't have any money.
Do they have cultural institutes in other countries still? Or not?
Well, they used to. There used to be this was not, there was a kind of privately funded, well, partly state, partly privately funded, what's it called, Foundation for Hellenic Culture.
Yeah.
And they had institutes in various countries, but they don't seem to have it I don't think it exists anymore. Certainly it doesn't exist in London, hasn't existed in London for some time. There is the Onassis Foundation, which has a centre in a very, very smart place in the middle of Manhattan. But it doesn't seem to do, you know, it concentrates on classics and Byzantium, you know, which I'm afraid a lot of Greeks, you know, they think that's the important thing to do. And they don't do very much about modern Greece at all. You know, there's something called the Hellenic Centre in London here in Baker Street, just off Baker Street, in a very good position. And that's with local Greek and Cypriot money from London.
Yeah.
And they put on some very good things. And but you know, somebody else was saying just now about, yes, you, Antonio, were saying about, you know, who buys these books, but it's either people who have boyfriends or girlfriends or poets.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you a story about the Hellenic Centre in Paddington Street, off Baker Street. They periodically put on presentations of, you know, new Greek poetry, new Greek fiction. They invite these people, you know, from Greece, and they come. They're all Greeks. The people who speak in favour of these authors are all Greek, almost always Greek. And at one thing that I was attending, the audience was, you know, pretty full. The person who was organising it said, you know, is anyone here who doesn't speak Greek? And only one person put their hand up. She turned out to be a little old Armenian lady. And so we had to have the whole thing in English for the benefit of this little old Armenian lady. Because otherwise the idea would be, well, let's just have it in Greek, you know, because nobody else is interested in our literature except Greeks. There, that's how it is. It's the same when you go to, you know, public events at King's College London. There's hundreds of people there, but they're almost entirely, you know, about modern Greece, almost entirely Greek.
I have the same thing with Polish audiences, that I'm always very, very keen to have my authors presented at literary festivals, because that's where you get a new audience, who people who've come to, say, Hay Festival, Edinburgh, they will have come for a few days, and there'll be some mega TV star that they're waiting to see. But they fill in the time. And it's great if it's raining, because they've got to go to events. And so they'll think, well, I wonder what this is. Let's go and see. And it's very nice when you feel like you're getting a fresh audience.
Yes.
And you can.
And they sometimes pair up, let us say, a Swedish writer with
someone
a UK writer.
Yeah.
And that can work quite well. Not always, but sometimes.
Yes.
And it gets in a different audience.
Yeah, there's a lot of events in and around the London Book Fair this year, if anyone's particularly interested in Polish literature, because of Poland being the market-focused country, to use the PR phrase. And that's exactly what we've been trying to do, is pair writers up with British writers whose names ring a bell, as a way of bringing people in and introducing them to a new writer, a Polish writer. But this thing about cultural institutes is interesting, because... as I said, we're very lucky with Polish translation that we have this dedicated organisation, the Polish Book Institute, it gets its funding from the Cultural Ministry. But the Poles also have Polish cultural institutes in various countries, in the kind of bigger capitals around the world. And those are attached to the Foreign Affairs Ministry. And so while the Polish Book Institute, which is based in Krakow, supports translation into any language and encourages translators a lot and works with us and has all sorts of amazing projects to support our work, the cultural institutes within the countries always have, well, their job is to promote their culture abroad, so they have sections for different genres, so they'll put on art exhibitions and film exhibitions and so on, and then they'll help us to set up literary events and bring authors over and have them appear and promote books and launch books, which is absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's the translator's dream to have this kind of support, because the difficulty is not translating your book, it's selling it.
Yeah.
And it's what, you know, you go through all the hurdles of getting a publisher and getting the book out there, but then people have to know that it exists. So the competition is huge, but you are talking about some of the best literature around, because it's had to go through that test of being accepted by a publisher who can't actually read it and so on. And with the Poles at the moment, there's a sort of political element here, because the Polish Book Institute was set up in the run-up to Poland joining the EU, so I think it started being fully functional in about 2000. and has always had the same staff all the way through and has always done an absolutely fantastic job. And then just over a year ago when the Law and Justice government came in Poland, which is extremely conservative and very right-wing by most people's standards, and has its own ideology which it has tried to impose across the board, and is very concerned about the perception of Poland. They claim they're concerned about the perception of Poland abroad. They don't want Poland to be seen as a country that treated the Jews badly in the war, for instance. So they want to promote Polish suffering during the war and bravery and martyrdom, yes. And they also want to promote a certain kind of political philosophy, which I think probably most people in this country have no interest in whatsoever. And so I've been asked by Poles recently, I was asked in a newspaper interview the other day, I was told that the Polish embassy in London, an event that had completely passed me by, had been promoting the biography of Lech Kaczynski. Hands up, if Polish people aren't allowed to take part in this, but hands up if you know who Lech Kaczynski is. Anybody know? Do you know who Lech Kaczynski is? Are you interested in reading his biography? No. Lech Kaczynski was the twin brother of Jarosław Kaczynski, and he was the president who insisted that they fly the plane to Smolensk in order to take part in a ceremony at Katyn to commemorate the Polish officers who were shot there by the Soviets during the war. And he had refused to go with the prime minister, who he didn't like, the day before, and he had refused to take part in any kind of event involving Vladimir Putin, who was kind of latching onto this to make himself look good. Although, of course, it was the Soviets who shot these people. So he insisted on flying this plane the next day and insisted on landing it when it was quite clear that the weather was not suitable, and the plane crashed and an awful lot of people were killed, a lot of top Polish dignitaries. It's a massive tragedy. And his surviving brother wishes him to be the kind of symbolic figure representing Polish suffering and martyrdom, and wants the whole world to know about him, and very much resents the fact that Lech Wałęsa is somebody who we have heard about and is doing everything he can to brand Wałęsa as an informer. So I had great fun saying to this woman who asked me in an interview whether the British public would be eagerly looking forward to a biography of Lech Kaczynski. I said, no, but I think they'd read one of Wałęsa. So politics can also creep into these things. Right. And
so would you also say that in other countries it's the case that the cultural institutes are interested in projecting some image externally or in other countries abroad? Because after all, I mean, some cultural institutes, I imagine, subsidize the books that are going to be translated, and maybe they have a great say in which books will be selected.
Well, the Swedes have generally tried to be so even-handed that they would never push anything to the fore, which has been quite frustrating actually for a number of decades. But now I would say they are falling over backwards to promote diversity. They don't want to be seen just as a race of blonde people. They are very, very keen to bring in all their second generation, third generation writers who are starting to write about the immigrant experience or the refugee experience or whatever. And people who don't look like them, you know, from their Minister of Culture to their half-Iranian, half-Swedish poet or whoever, they are very keen to push that sort of thing at the moment.
Yes, the Dutch are very keen on balance as well.
Yes.
And I was at an event a few weeks ago in London called High Impact from the Low Countries, which looked surprisingly white middle class, I have to say. In the middle of the road. I didn't see much diversity. Plenty of balance, but not much diversity.
Well, as I say, I mean, the cultural institutes, you know, don't a shadow of their former selves. And also, as I said, when they did exist, they like the Onassis Foundation in New York, they tend to be promoting classical Greece and Byzantium, you see, and then modern Greece is a sort of little addendum at the end, which occasionally they have a sop, you know, to their own culture. You know, they actually put on something about their own culture rather than their ancestors' culture.
Is it some, this sort of slight inferiority complex?
Oh, yeah, but superiority as well, because they are the only descendants of the ancient
culture.
But it kind of, yeah, anyway, let's not go into that, because it's a very sore point. I've been living with this for the last 50 years. It's the bane of my life.
The postcard I bought when I was on holiday and was, the gods lived here.
Let me just have one last question. Because some of you are involved in mentorship schemes, and I wonder if you have any advice for beginning or emerging translators. Rather than choose a different language.
Rob a bank. Find a very rich person to support you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Partner up with someone with a steady income. No, but really, I would say practice, do it. Commune with translators, go to festivals, go to translation slams, bookshop events, library events. I'm sure there are plenty of opportunities for that in Oxford compared to where I live. Join organisations, join the Emerging Translators
Network. Emerging Translators Network.
If you're translating from Swedish, lucky enough to do that, you can join our CELTA group, Swedish English Literary Translators Association. Later on, when you've actually got a contract, you can join the Translators Association, which is all sorts of things combined. It's all like
a union.
It will give you legal advice. It will give you comradeship. It will get you out of the house to meet other translators. It's quite expensive, but it's worth it. When I first joined, it took 10% of my annual income from translating, so that was a big leap of faith to join. Just get on with practicing translation, even if you haven't got an outlet for it, I would say.
Okay.
I've got nothing to say.
Do you want to say something?
No, I think I've said enough.
I mean, I've probably said far too much already, but I can say something about starting out, because I am the co-chair of the Translators Association, so kind of duty-bound. So there are certain things that you can do if you are very keen to become a literary translator. As Sarah mentioned, there's something called the Emerging Translators Network, which is an online forum. Mm. And it's a very good thing, because it's a place where if you don't feel like you know anything and you're terrified that your question might be a bit silly or whatever, it doesn't matter. You can ask it. And there are lots of other people who have either started fairly recently or have founded the thing, and so they can answer your questions. And there's various things that people aren't aware of, such as that there are lots and lots of online journals. There are some specifically that publish translated work. Mm. And it's a very good place to get your first stuff published. And I often do this with my mentees, to get to know the journals like Asymptote and Words Without Borders and World Literature Today. And there are now lots and lots and lots of online things. And you can send things into them for their consideration, and they might publish you. So it's worth knowing those things. If you are keen to get started, really the best thing is if you've found something you really are obsessed with translating and you feel very strongly that you would like to work on and you think should exist in English, the first thing, the golden rule, check the rights situation before you translate a single word. Because it may be that the rights are not available, it may be that somebody else is already working on it, it may be that that writer has a dedicated translator and won't let anybody else near their work.
Or the agent might. That's
and there
what
might
we're
be
increasingly
an agent who is
fussy.
Like a brick wall.
Yes.
Some languages,
yes.
I mean, poor old Japanese translators, they have a terrible time because the agents won't let them near the writers.
No.
And then sometimes... So find out the situation, and if you're not sure how, the book should have at least the name of the publisher in it. You can write to them and you can ask. But you may find something that where they'd be very keen to have, and we're supposed to be talking about so-called marginalised I can't bear this term, how can we call them marginalised when we've devoted most of our lives to languages. If you are interested in working on languages where there isn't so much translated, there's probably an ocean of good stuff out there, and it doesn't have to be contemporary, it could be something old. And it's useful to find out, and this is something you can learn from other translators, and we're a pretty friendly bunch, we all know each other and get together a lot and help each other, and it's
a very nice
world.
In answer to your question of earlier, we have great solidarity.
We do.
We some rivalry, of course, but also solidarity.
A lot of helping each other. And so there are ways in which to pitch books to publishers. And I mean, the mentorships are an absolutely wonderful thing. If you study Writers' Centre Norwich's site, it's not offered for a large number of languages, but that is an extremely good way to advance your career by being mentored by somebody who's been doing this for a long time, like us. But essentially, supposing you find a wonderful book and you really, really want to translate it and you feel confident to do it and you have found out that the rights are free and the publisher and the writer are very happy for you to go ahead and do something about it. On the whole, it's no point sending a book in a foreign language to a British publisher and saying, this is marvellous, I love this, please would you publish this, I want to translate it, because it will simply go on a pile that's gathering dust in their office, and that even if they had three lives, they wouldn't have time to get to. So what you have to do is prepare some digestible material for them, and you have to write a so-called book report, where you give the main facts about the book, then you give a summary of the book, and then you give a sort of review of the book, saying, well, what's so great about this book? Why do I love it so much? And why should you publish it?
And preferably comparing it to some writers that they will actually recognise the work of.
Place it for them. And then some decent samples, translate some excerpts for them, and study what each publisher does. Look at their websites, see what sort of things they publish. It's no good just writing to any old publisher. You have to show that you've taken an interest in what they do. Because every publisher has its own list and its own specific approach. And within every publisher, every editor has their own list. And they're all the younger editors are trying to carve out their own little niche. So it's worth studying their website.
Thank you so much for this advice, and thank you for the fascinating discussion that I'm sure convinced a lot of us that these languages are not marginalised at all and should not be definitely forgotten. But before I open the floor to further questions, maybe you'd like to share with us some excerpts from your translations you're working on currently, or would you like to read out?
Well, I mean, I've got two alternatives really, to read just the first paragraph of a wonderful short story published in 1892, which to my knowledge is the first work of fiction ever to be written in the second person. And most people think that it's the first fictional work in the second person. It's La Modification by Butor, published in 1957. But the alternative, I've got some frivolous modern haikus about European philosophers. I think you might want the haikus. Why not? This is written by Haris Ravionos, who, in the middle of the Greek crisis, decides to write some totally frivolous poems. They've got nothing to do with the Greek crisis whatsoever. I'll read, let's see, maybe five or six haikus. Each one is named after a philosopher. I'm going to read them in chronological order. Pythagoras, and then there's a quotation from an ancient source about Pythagoras, first of all in prose. He enjoined abstention from beans, either because they are like the privy parts, or because they are like the gates of Hades. Like the poem. How repulsive are these pulses? They remind me of hungry pussies. John Locke. An essay concerning human understanding. The mind is just a clean slate, tabula rasa, born stupid, die dumb. François-Marie Darouet, otherwise known as Voltaire, Candide ou l'optimisme, Jean-Jacques, he's crazy. Bon sauvage, he can't make a Tarzan out of me. Martin Heidegger, Being and Time. You're not only a human being, but Dasein. Spend your Zeit on Sein. And then two more, more recent, Noam Chomsky, Syntactic Structures. All languages have a universal grammar. Just ask your children. And the most modern, which is, I'm afraid to say, the only woman in Harris's book, Martha Nussbaum, The Fragility of Goodness. Living is fragile. Sophocles knew it too well, but Plato didn't.
I've brought an entry from my latest published translation, which was it's called A World Gone Mad, quite appropriately. The Diaries of Astrid Lindgren, 1939-45. Astrid Lindgren, as you know, wrote the children's book Pippi Longstocking and many, many other children's books for which she became world famous. But she is writing this in May 1943, at a time just before she has written Pippi Longstocking. She's just taking her first steps as a writer, really. She's a wife and mother. She's working at the censor's office, where she gets to see a lot of very worrying material that she can't read in the press about what's going on in the Second World War out in the world. She's feeling very, very guilty about Sweden's neutral stance, and she's feeling extremely lucky that they've got so much in the way of food and so on when the rest of Europe hasn't. So she writes, and it's such a wonderful mixture of world events and little domestic trivia, if you like. So warm and so lovely, what a blessing, unbelievably good weather. The day before yesterday, Karin turned 9, that's her daughter. Elsa-Lena and Matta were here. Karin got a watch, a school bag, a box of chocolates, a book and a pair of over trousers from us and several books from our visitors. For dinner, we had prawns, radishes, sardines, ham and eggs and the rest of the cake. I'm back at work on Monday after a delightful week and a half off for a terrible cold. While I was in bed, I wrote a few odds and ends and sent them into Stockholm's Tidningen, which bought one of my light articles and returned 3, then to Dagens Nyheter, which returned both the pieces I'd sent them. On one of them, Staffan Schierneld had written some comments, starting with, quote, "The girl can write, there's no question about it," unquote. But it was too short and not true enough to life, ha ha. Enough of this drivel. A minor detail such as Stalin dissolving the Comintern probably deserves a mention. It was in the papers yesterday and has caused a great stir all around the world, of course. It would mean that Bolshevism has renounced the idea of world revolution. I very much doubt that's the case. The Comintern will still exist, but undercover, and the whole device has probably just been dreamt up to curry favour with public opinion in Britain and America. I can't remember if I wrote that the British bombed 2 so-called barrages in Germany, resulting in huge destruction and large-scale flooding. A German Jew in exile is said to have given the British the idea, which will now be the excuse for fresh persecution of the Jews in Germany. That's all for today.
Yeah, this is from... it's about a fantasy rail journey from the northeastern tip of the Netherlands to Amsterdam, and it's going to appear in a book of Amsterdam tales to be published this year by Oxford University Press. Single to Amsterdam by Remco Campert. Sometimes you wish the Netherlands was bigger, so we feel less like we were huddling together on a wet clump of earth. Now you can easily cover, if you want, the whole stretch from Amsterdam to Groningen, there and back, twice in a day. That idea gives you the creeps. How much more spacious our lives would become, for example, if the journey from Groningen to Amsterdam took a day and a night. Your family would take you to the station and see you off. You'd be given a nice basket full of provisions to take with you. An uncle with burst veins on his nose and cheeks, who'd been in the capital before, would lend you his most precious possession. A map of Amsterdam, which was torn at the folds and badly outdated, but which, as far as the principal sites of the city were concerned, would be up to date. Uncle also gave you the address of a cheap but cheerful restaurant, where he had eaten every day of the week he spent in Amsterdam. If coming out of the station you walked straight ahead for 2 hours and took the fourth street on your left, you couldn't miss it. It was called McDonald's, and it certainly wouldn't do any harm if you mentioned Uncle's name. The train finally got underway and rolled into the wide world of the Netherlands. Who knows to what adventure? The landscape soon became strange. Familiar Groningen seemed a long way behind you. On either side of the tracks, the plain stretched endlessly. Herds of wild cows sometimes trotted along with the train for a while. Sometimes you passed a hamlet, so small that the train did not deign to stop there. The people rushed out and waved at the monster thundering past their lives. In the afternoon, they reached Assen, where the train stopped for a long time. You hung out of the compartment window and took everything in. Assen, it went through you. You could get off here and start a new anonymous life. Not a soul would worry about you again. You would also dress in Assen costume, a smock made of coloured handkerchiefs. You would marry a fat-bottomed Assen girl who would bear you lots of children. Slowly you would rise in their esteem, but you would still remain a stranger all your life. You didn't dare go onto the platform, frightened that the train would depart unexpectedly and abandon you in a future you weren't yet ready for. The train left. Dusk crept over the fields. You looked at the other travellers, all people passed with a past of their own. A man with a pale, lined face opposite you had a case full of combs and pencils, which he hoped to sell in Amsterdam. A woman was going to visit her son, whom she had not seen for 15 years. Finally, she'd been able to scrape together the money for the journey. And what did they think of you? Perhaps that you were an interprovincial spy. Furtively, you felt your nascent moustache. At night, the train stood still for hours in a large railway yard lit by cold moonlight. Now you were in Amersfoort, you knew. Legendary Amersfoort that had connections with Apeldoorn, Nijmegen, Culemborg, all those bubbling metropolises that you knew of only by hearsay. Your fellow travellers were snoring, but you were too excited to sleep. From outside came mysterious sounds, clanging of metal on metal, the crunch of shoes on gravel, the snatch of a voice. Outside they were working, but you could not see. A light went past. Above everything, the trembling night sky. This was life. This was the world. Before your eyes finally closed too, you imagined how from now on you would travel would dominate your life. After Amsterdam, you also wanted to see Rotterdam, and perhaps another time you would call in at Hook of Holland. You couldn't go any further, as you would fall off the edge of the world. At the end of the morning, you arrived in Amsterdam. What a lot of water, what a lot of towers and tall buildings, what a lot of people. How would you ever find McDonald's in this confusion? On the platform was a nice man who knew of a hotel for you. He took charge of your case and walked so fast ahead of you with it that you had a job following him. They were a helpful lot anyway, those Amsterdammers.
I've only got a little short thing for you. I'm translating a book by Jacek Dejnel, and it's called Lala. And it's all about his grandmother, who was always called Lala all her life. And she was always telling him all these anecdotes. So he wrote them all down, and it's the story of her life told through these endlessly repeated anecdotes, and she's with him interrupting her now and then. And she grew up at a Polish manor house in the countryside between the wars, and which was her grandparents' house. And when she got married, she still went on living there. And you need to know for the purposes of this that her husband was called Julek, and her grandmother was Granny Vanda. And the house was called Lisuf. Okay, so at our place at Lisuf, everything was full of calcium and selenium, the earth, the water, and the air. So the peasants never did any singing. Of course, they had some sort of ditties. When the women were working in the fields, now and then one of them got up and sang something like, "For no one do I cry, saving Mikawai. He strained the sock and burned his sock." And the older they were, the bawdier the rhyme. But apart from that, as a rule, they only had instrumental music. Of course, they played fabulously at the weddings. They played beautifully, but they never sang because their throats were eaten away. But for all that, they never suffered from cancer, and the doctor told me that if I'd lived there for all that time, I'd never get it either. Well, anyway, making soup with that water was impossible because with all those minerals in it, some of the vegetables were soon cooked to a pulp and some were almost raw, so it came out a mess. In any case, Granny Vanda didn't know how to cook and none of her maids could cook either. So my father was always used to say, "At the Brockles, even the turkey is revolting," because father was a great gourmet.
but not even a master chef could have made good soup without water. And while I was ill, for some time, Julek made the dinners. Dinners as dinners go. The second course was quite tasty, but the soups, what soups, they were wonderful. Everything cooked to perfection, absolutely delicious, full of flavour. He refused to betray his secret, but he was proud as a peacock. One day he told me, "Today I'm going to fix you a Lucullan feast." And he kept adding one, then a second, then a third ingredient, bringing me some to try now and then, until he'd thrown in so many things it became inedible. But anyway, apart from that one time when he went overboard, his soups were exquisite. Finally, with a lot of caresses and mock threats, I got him to reveal the secret of his recipe to me. And he says, "You know what, I don't really know why my soups come out so well. I get water from the barrel, I peel..." "From the barrel?" I ask. "Yes, you know, the one under the house." It was the rainwater barrel where our farm help, Bakalarchik, used to wash the muck off his hands whenever he came in from the field. It was full of mosquito larvae, and if you put your hand close to the water's surface, they made a sort of trrrr sound deep down and were gone in an instant, not to mention how many even tinier beasties were swarming about in there. And quick as a flash, we went back to our nasty lease of soups.